With Spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop Spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Send it up into the sky. We're calling it Parks and Recollection. Come on, little podcast, spread your wings and fly.
Welcome, welcome to Parks and Recollection on a Saturday recorded session. I don't know when you're listening to this, but just so you know, we're doing this on a Saturday. That's how into it Alan Yang and I are.
That's how much we love you. That's how much we love the listener.
Anyway, I am one of your hosts, Rob Lowe. Happy Saturday.
Happy Saturday, Rollo. How are you?
I'm so good. It's Saturday, so I'm moving a little slow. But hopefully nobody will be able to notice that when they listen to this.
Yeah, I just housed some breakfast tacos from Home State. So apologize if I'm sluggish. I just ate a bunch of breakfast tacos.
We're going to get to do a scientific experiment then, because I did not eat anything.
Okay, great.
And my wife was like, you can't do that. You can't just run out of the house.
We're going to see the dynamic between a hungry man and a very full man on this episode. Let's see how that works.
It's going to be riveting. What do we got today? We got a good one, right?
Well, speaking of food, we got one called Sweetums. Classic app. Classic middle of season 2 app. Episode 15 of season 2 aired February 4th, 2010. Written by Alan Yang, that's me, directed by Dean Holland. This was the third episode of Parks I ever wrote, and it felt like it was in some ways the first normal one, normal-ish one, because the first one was first season, and the second one was a very, very wild one, guest starring Fred Armisen, called Sister City, which we've talked about previously, which was a very, very weird episode. And this one was like, oh, this is about Leslie and Ron, and it's kind of Wheelhouse Parks and Rec, standard season 2 episode. So let me just describe it right now with the synopsis. How about that,
please,
Rob?
Do. Oh, wait, just are you going to put extra sauce on this because you actually wrote this episode?
Extra sweetener for Sweetums, for sure.
Yes. Good.
Here we go. The Pawnee Parks and Recreation Department, heard of it, considers a potential sponsorship deal with Sweetums, a local candy manufacturer hoping to market nutritious snack bars to park visitors. Nutritious is in quotes, so you know they're not nutritious. Ron supports the deal as he emphasizes consumer choice over public safety. Leslie supports the deal as well until Anne informs her they are filled with unhealthy corn syrup. Leslie arranges a public forum so they can make an informed choice about Sweetums products. During the forum, Sweetums representatives screen propaganda films highlighting consumer satisfaction, while Leslie responds by screening a 30-year-old Sweetums film which discusses how corn syrup and other snack bar ingredients make cattle unhealthy. At the end of Leslie's screening, Sweetums brings in the company's dashingly handsome CEO, Nick Newport Jr., and his kids. The forum audience cheers with excitement when the Newports give them free candy and ultimately votes in favor of the sponsorship deal. All the while, Leslie comments on Ron's unhealthy food choices, like drinking too much and ordering the Turf and Turf, which is 2 steaks. Ron later apologizes to Leslie for having, quote, been a horse's ass. For the B-plot, Tom attempts to move out of his home after his divorce from Wendy. Mark reluctantly helps Tom with his pickup truck. The Parks Department also helps with a move, while Tom himself works very little. At the end of the episode, Tom learns that his new home has a gas leak and that he's unable to move it until Monday. Tom asks the gang to take the boxes into their own homes, but they ultimately bring in the possessions and leave them in the Parks Department office. That is the episode synopsis. A lot going on.
Yeah. I knew corn syrup was bad, but I didn't know why. And I learned why it's bad in this episode when it's something that was made because it's sweeter than sugar, which is obviously great if you can figure that out. And it's cheaper than sugar, hence why it's in almost everything that's bad for you.
It's a very educational episode. Actually, everything in the world is like made of corn. Like everything America makes is made, like every product is basically corn. Like bread is part corn. Like everything's corn. Things that you don't think are corn. It's like the cheapest thing to make.
So one of the things I loved was the Sweetums commercial launching the healthy bar was. It looks like a frame for frame parody of a Coors commercial.
Yeah. And it was like lit up all bright. I remember shooting that. I think that was up at Disney Ranch along with some of the other stuff we shot, but we took a trip up there and it was really funny. The guy in his vest and with his dog and, like splashing water in his face from a cool mountain spring. Like it was very, that was really fun to shoot. And this one, you got to shoot like some educational film stuff. And, we were all over the place we mentioned this in our episode with Dean Holland, but we felt like we were kind of kids running the store because, you know, again, I was a fairly young writer and this was his second episode ever directing. And again, there was no parental supervision. It was just the two of us on site. I distinctly remember the feeling. I believe we were shooting the public forum scene and we had some questions. Like, we weren't sure how to shoot. Like, literally weren't sure how to shoot it. We were like, should we do it this way? Should we do that? I was like, it's just us, man. There's no one else here. We're just doing it. And it all worked out. Dean became a terrific director. So it was fun to learn with him.
I was obsessed with the Newport family. And this is before we meet Paul Rudd, who plays, he must be the brother of these people, right?
Yeah. Another good looking kind of dummy. Paul Rudd playing a dummy in the show. But
he's so funny.
So Bobby Newport comes in later. And yeah, he did a ton of episodes, man. It was, he did more than you think. And it was really fun. I directed an episode he was in. And the guy is just he's a machine. He's so funny. Like I remember giving him notes and he was like, like just very friendly listening. I was like, did he even listen to anything? And then the next take, he did it perfectly, like better than I could have pitched it to him. He was a comedy machine.
The red vest, got this puffy red vest. I have a thing about vests. I do. They say something, I don't know. And I don't want to, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people right now, this is a Saturday and they're in their vests and they're like taking a walk and they got us on their, you know, fucking headphones or whatever. And now I'm going to shit all over their vest. I don't want to do that, but it says something very specific. There's something very, very specific about. Now, granted, it could have been worse. It could have been a fleece vest.
Yes.
You know, that sort of
a tech vest.
That Jeff Bezos, you know, conference up in the mountains vest.
Zippered pockets. I'm going to Aspen for a business conference.
Yes.
And by the way, right now, again, tons of people are definitely wearing vests and taking hikes and listening to this podcast. You know, you're in San Francisco. I don't want to color a whole city, but you see a lot of vests in San Francisco in the Bay Area, just like walking around.
In fact, if they were making the Streets of San Francisco TV show today, it would be the vests of San Francisco.
Yes,
there's no question about it.
And also the kids run in with vests. That's happening in this episode. Like the kids run in with an identical vest.
Oh.
Yes, the episode was pretty much built around the concept of making fun of people wearing vests. And then we built it from there.
Well, I would go even further. I would say the episode is built under the concept of making fun of the general public because the people of Pawnee are complete idiots. And it makes me laugh that they're just like, yay, candy. They're just so funny that Leslie lays out this beautifully articulated, you know, reason why this is a bad thing. And then the Newports go, I don't know, look under your seats. And there's candy under the seats. And they just go, yeah. And they just, it's so great.
It's so funny because it really is kind of a seminal episode in terms of, you know, determining what these town halls are going to be. You know, we had done them previously, but this one we started to go further and further. And the way Dean cut it also was like, you know, just jump cuts between different, different, you know, people in the public. And we're like, oh, every one of these can just be a wild joke and it doesn't really matter, right? And it's just, there's no continuity or anything like that. So it was fun. And it was fun to write those. We would just write, you know, as a writing staff, we would just pitch a ton of them and then decide kind of what to do on the day and kind of give them to random people. And then we brought back our favorite actors from these public forums because it would make sense that the same weirdos would come to all of them. So that was really fun too.
Yeah, I was going to ask how you cast the you know, regular folks of Pawnee. And that makes perfect sense because, you know, you're giving one line to somebody and you, yes, know, you never know how they're going to, whether they're going to have game or not till you get on the set.
Yes. And eventually we had some guys kind of recur. Like we had this guy, Mel Cowan, who would come in and he would scream. I mean, he came back again and again. It's like, he was a really, really fun. And also sometimes the writers would come in and do it. So Mike Scully, one of the writers, started appearing in episodes as just a weird townsperson, and his name was Pearl for some reason. So he would come back and do stuff. But yeah, public forum was really fun in this one.
The discussion, the political discussion of Ron Swanson's thing, and if he's like an individual should have the right to consume whatever they want in their own bodies. And the government should not be involved in that conversation.
You know, the elements of Ron Swanson, obviously people think about the manly stuff, the woodworking, the meat, all that stuff. But ultimately, originally he was conceived as a libertarian. That was a really important part of his character. And so this was kind of focusing on that side of him where he was like, yeah, I hate government. I hate government. I work in government, but I hate government and they shouldn't tell me what to do. And that was, you know, that was one of the challenges in breaking this episode was, we knew that the framework was this kind of theoretical, ideological disagreement between Leslie and Ron. But then it's like, how do you make that emotional? How do you make that a personal story? Because, you know, look, there have been great works of art made that are just appealing to the head, but we generally wanted to make episodes that appeal to the heart. So it was kind of combining that into the idea that she was trying to manage his business about his personal life. And so it wasn't just government. It was Leslie trying to micromanage Ron. And that was kind of a metaphor for government micromanaging citizens' lives. So that was kind of how we broke it open.
Yeah, it felt really timely.
Yeah, it still is. Still is. I laughed when I turned it on. The first thing was this cold open where Tom is trying on outfits for Justin. And it really took me back because some of those outfits, Aziz and I had taken a trip to Universal Studios and we walked around Universal City Walk. And if for those of you who know, it's like a... it's kind of like a nightmare mall. It's like a Buca di Beppo and like all, you know, like Bubba Gump Shrimp Company and like a Margaritaville or whatever. And so there's these street vendors and a couple of street vendors, they included a shirt with a sort of that lights up when you talk, that so it has little like sound level bars. And then there was also another vendor that had a belt buckle that had messages you could program on it digitally. And so we're like, these are so dumb, we've got to buy these and put them in the show. And so we had the prop department buy a bunch and then we just put them in the show.
I thought you made them up.
And this is early on in the show, right? This was season two. So yeah, a belt buckle that says "What's Crackin'," a perfect accessory for Tom Haverford. So,
what's crackin'?
Yeah. You use your personal experiences and put it into the show.
It made me laugh. It's so perfect. I thought you couldn't have made it up, and turns out you didn't.
Life is always real stuff is always the best. It's always that was also like this is very minor, but the Newport's dog, this is a golden retriever, we named him Shoelace because that was the name of my friend Reed's dog, and Shoelace would come over. I was living in a house in Hancock Park with like five other writers. It was like a writer flop house, and we had this pool in the backyard, and Reed and Shoelace, his dog, would come over, and Shoelace would immediately jump into the pool every time. So in honor of Shoelace, we named the golden retriever in this episode after him.
I'm a big believer in like people should spend more time on the names of their pets.
Yeah,
I think, or they should either spend more time or less time.
Yes. I also like when the pet has, sometimes I like it when the pet has a human name, right? It's like,
oh, that's me.
It's just like, oh, this dog's named Greg. It's like, what? Like,
well, I'll do one better. You know, John Lovitz, right? Of course.
Yeah.
So John Lovitz likes to name his dogs after people who he knows. And he has a dog named after the great producer, Jerry Bruckheimer's wife, Linda Bruckheimer. So his dog will be like, so, and he says it so I can say, oh my God, there's Linda Bruckheimer taking a shit in the backyard again.
That's pretty funny. I once dated a woman who's who named her cat after her dad. So it was very confusing. I was like, do you want dominion over your, is that what's going on here? Like you're working out some issues with your cat?
I also like really stupid names. Like I had a dog once named Ed Chocolate Head because he had an actual head that was chocolate covered. He was a German short-haired pointer and their heads are always a different color. So I just loved, it was so dumb. Ed Chocolate Head, come here. And people are like, what's wrong with you?
It's a very long name for a dog too.
It is a long
name. You put it on its collar, he needs four collars to fit the name on it, but yeah. Oh man.
With Spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop Spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Again, this example of people using their personal lives, we used some of Nick's woodworking knowledge because, you know, he brings in that harp and he says, I used a bandsaw, a spoke shave, and an oscillating spindle sander to make this harp. And it's like, yeah, we didn't write that. We just like, we put like, yeah, Nick make up some woodworking shit and took a trip to his actual wood shop. And that's why we kind of incorporated it. And then we ended up shooting there for a different episode. So that's coming up. There's also a trip to the library, which I think we later did whole episodes, but there's a little journey to the library in this one.
I didn't know you could check out archaic Super 8 movies at the library. I learned that in this episode.
I always love in a movie, like old movies where the characters go to the library and like looking in card catalogs. And then I really love microfiche. And Joanna just put in the chat, but it is the, because I remember like this is how old I am. Like I remember going to the library and like looking at microfiche of old newspapers to do research for a project. And it's like for anyone under the age of like 30, microfiche is you load these things into a magazine that magnifies the image like really greatly, so you can store a lot of newspapers on small, you know, little I don't even know what they're called.
Wasn't there a crank on it that would go,
like, I mean, it sounds like we were born in the 1800s. Like anyone listening to this now, we're speaking in a very modern medium, the medium of podcasts, and people are probably listening on AirPods with their fucking phone. But like we're talking about like the Dewey Decimal System, yes, and microfiche, which is but it's real, man. That the struggle was real.
And
wasn't that long ago.
Anytime you're saying the word microfiche, it's so good. It makes you feel both like it's a clown word, but it also is very like, you know, like you're in the CIA at the same time.
I just think of microfiche. Like a John Grisham. Like I always felt like I was in the Library of Congress and it was going to zoom out in those like large concentric circles in that room where you're studying and like, I'm going to crack this case. But in reality, I was just writing like a history paper or something.
It's very All the President's Men.
Yeah, man. Pelican Brief, like all that shit, man. It was
microfiche. You got to have the chanting guys stand up and yell that in the town.
Yeah, microfiche is a... never forget it. Never forget it. Another classic. First appearance of DJ Roomba in this episode. One of the weirdest things I ever got into the show. I wrote that in my first draft, and Roombas were a little newer, right? So this was back when Roombas were new. And by the way, it's not a phone on top of the Roomba. It's an iPod. This is a decade ago. It was like an iPod. And I remember Mike reading the writer's draft, my draft of the script, and he was like, I don't understand what this is at all, but I'm trying to trust you on this. And so he's like, he asked the other writers, and they were like, yeah, it's funny. So we built it and it worked. It was like a Roomba with an iPod on it. And he was like, well, I don't understand it, but people seem to think it's funny. So it got in the episode.
It's one of my favorite things in the history of the show. It just is. It's one of my all-time favorite things. It makes me so happy. I don't know what it is. It's like seeing a dolphin in the wild. It just releases pheromones. When I see DJ Roomba, that's the way I feel.
It's whimsical. It's very whimsical. It's also funny when it's he's so sad when Jerry breaks it. It's like
he was like a child to me.
Yeah,
he's like a son.
Jerry,
to
what
me.
Are you doing? You killed DJ Roomba.
You killed DJ Roomba.
And the ultimate, really, the true mark of insanity is in the tag of the episode when we did the ghost of DJ Roomba, and he's playing Black Eyed Peas on a nonstop loop,
oh.
And that's like it goes to credits. But that is when you know the lunatics have taken over the asylum, is when we allow that to happen in the episode.
You know, as we do this, like you said the other day, you're discovering my taste.
Yeah, that's your favorite shit.
Dude, that ghost DJ Roomba thing is it for me. It's the most genius thing ever. I mean, first of all, the way he looked, it's so cute, the way the little ghost looks.
It's really cute. It lived up to exactly what I was picturing. I was like, it's going to have a little sheet, and it's going to have two little eyes. And then I think Dean also mentioned this when he was on, but he, you know, we did a shot from between Jerry's legs, and that was when we realized the concept of this being a documentary was out the window, and we're like, we're just going to shoot this regular. Yeah. We're just going to shoot this regular. So the ghost of DJ Roomba broke the documentary.
Which is interesting. That's an interesting thing out there. Like, at what point have we crossed the Rubicon to, like, just going for it? And now we know what it was. It was the between Jerry's legs shot to the ghost of DJ Roomba.
Yeah, and you actually feel like the number of talking heads ends up decreasing over time, over the course of the show, and it just becomes, you know, again, like you said, we mentioned The Office at the beginning of this episode, it just became more and more different from The Office, and I thought, I think that's a good thing, as it became its own show.
Would you say that the talking heads not only decreased, but they went from more story-driven, albeit comedic, to just flat-out jokes? Because for me, by the time I got on the show, it felt like the talking heads were an amazing opportunity pretty much just to be funny.
Yeah, and I always kind of felt, this is just my own personal taste, but I always felt like using them for exposition or, to give information out, or, in the writer's room, we call that laying pipe, just like get the pipe out to the story. It's just a little lazy, It's like, because it could have put one of the art, like part of the artfulness of writing is trying to get exposition across in scenes. But in this format, you can just have a character say to camera what's happening, which is, you can always do. We did it. Trust me, we did it a lot. But ultimately, we had kind of rules where we didn't love to do that. And we also tried to not necessarily have a character just say how they're feeling in the talking head, because that also feels like a little bit of a cheat. And we always thought it was a little more elegant to have them, first of all, just do a joke, or second of all, say something that hides how they feel but implies the opposite or something. I always felt like, and that goes, that I think that's fairly decent advice for scenes in general, right? Like, have characters be a little bit cagey about how they feel, so they're not just, they're just like saying how they feel. Of course, the network will always tell you, like, can you just have them say how they feel? And it's like, that's not good writing, man. It's a network noty type thing. But yeah,
I always wish, and look, I don't mean, it's just an easy target to bash networks and their creative people, because, actually, I always feel like whenever you get a network note, however bad, for the most part, there's some germ of issue. Or not, I don't know if it's truth, but there is some reason that they're bumping on something. Now, 9 times out of 10, they've given you the wrong fix.
Right.
And it's a little bit for me like going to a chiropractor, where you go, God, my shoulder, it's my shoulder. My problem is my shoulder. And the chiropractor goes, actually, it all stems from this, and it's your hip that is putting pressure on your shoulder. And the network never knows it. They always go right to the shoulder, but the problem may be something else in the script, and they just don't have the sophistication or the ability to understand what they're actually bumping up against.
I think that's pretty savvy, and I can tell you've been in the business for a while because I feel the same way. I don't really have an adversarial or antagonistic relationship with any executives I've ever worked with, quite frankly. I think, honestly, like, I've had a ton of good executives. I think I've had a lot of executives who ultimately, look, it's been my experience, and this is just me speaking, but they're smart people generally who want to support the show and make it great, the same as you do, right? And to me, it's just another set of eyes. It's just hopefully a smart, experienced person who's read a lot of scripts, and they just give you their thoughts, right? And that's okay. Like, that's totally okay. And I feel like I've been fortunate in the sense that it's always been a conversation. It's always been like, well, let's talk about it. And I agree with you. Every script needs to be rewritten a million times, quite frankly. Like, you should be rewriting it a ton of times before the network even sees it, and be prepared to rewrite it after they see it. Because I totally think if they diagnose something, again, look, it's all taste, and they may be right, they may be wrong, but if they say 10 things about a script, I usually am like, oh yeah, these three or four are right, and let's fix it. And I don't, you know, look, it's my job to rewrite. It's not like, oh, it's gold and let's shoot it, right? I never feel that way. So no, I mean, I know there's some writers out there who despise executives, them. Look, I mean, maybe there, I'm sure there are bad ones out there, but I don't put myself in that category. It's like, yeah, it's just a smart person reading it, hopefully. And, you know, you can agree and disagree. By the way, the other thing is, like, I've been fortunate in the sense that it's not absolute, you fix these things, you do them the way we tell you to. I've never had executives do that to me, so I feel lucky in that sense.
Has there been a difference in working with on a network show and then going into a place like Netflix or Hulu or streaming, or you kind of, that's really where you work at the most, for the most point now?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, well, I feel like, again, I keep saying this over and over again because I do feel this way. I feel like I've been lucky. Like, so on Parks and Rec, for instance, you know, obviously it was mainly Mike dealing with the network, but I got to sit in on some of these sessions later on in the run of the show, and our exec on Parks, Lauren Anderson, was phenomenal, and she was really smart and just supportive of the show. And she had thoughts on scripts, of course, but she trusted Mike and Greg, and that was really smart because
she understood the show. That's
understood
the number one thing.
And I believe was there the entire run, so just got the show and had smart ideas and suggestions. And was like, well, what if this is a two-parter? What if? So that was great. And then, but you're right. Once you get in the streaming world, I mean, I've now worked with Netflix and Amazon and Apple and all these networks. It's kind of really fun. Like, when we did Master None, Netflix was like 6 employees. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but they literally had 2 shows when we sold Master None to Netflix. They had made House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, and that was it. And so it was a very nascent company. I remember pitching to Ted Sarandos in City Hall in like a small conference room, and they bought the show. And it's like, now Ted Sarandos is worth like $1 billion or something. But you got the kind of Wild West feeling, right? It's like they kind of gave you some freedom. And by the way, our executive on Master, Andy Weil, who's a great executive, was great taste. He came over from Universal. He had worked with us at Universal and was our Universal exec. So it's kind of the same kind of guy. So I feel lucky in that sense.
Yeah, it's good when, you know, I did a show called The Grinder, which I love. I love The Grinder.
Classic
show.
It's
one of my favorite things I've ever done. I mean, I put it up there against any comedy. But, you know, on one hand, I was grateful for Fox for putting it on because it was like stunningly weird show that I couldn't believe a network put on TV. So I you know, without them, we don't even have a show. But then I don't think they really ever understood. Well, I know they didn't understand it. And one of the things I loved about The Grinder it was that it would open with a cold open that was the TV show within the show. And their big thing is, do we have to do those? I think we should just start the show. And I was like, they're the most funny part. And they go, yeah, but we think that the audience thinks that's the show. You know, at that moment, you're kind of on life support because they intrinsically either don't understand the show or don't like it.
Yeah. And it's always an uphill battle. And to me, that note smacks of, you know, you and the creative auspices of the show want to trust the audience and respect them. You know, it's like, no, we trust that they're smart and they can watch a 2-minute cold open and understand that's the fictional show within a show, and it's funny and they can enjoy it and they understand that. And I think, you know, respecting the audience's intelligence is one of, you know, the most important things to me. It's really, really fundamental to making good stuff.
We say that as we're talking about an episode where the people are idiots.
The entire public. No show has shown more disdain towards the American public than Parks and Recreation. If you're not a main character in the show, you're an absolute moron.
You're candy!
Exactly. You're loud. You're barely capable of rational thought from how they're portrayed in this show. But the main characters are lovely. They're very intelligent, smart, empathetic people. But yeah. Some jokes I just wanted to shout out. I really just liked when Leslie says she's already written a eulogy for Ron. It's called "Oh Captain, My Captain, Ron Swanson, A Swan Song," which is a phenomenal joke. I believe it was Harris Whittles. You know, it's just like you do the rewrite and you get a little gem like that in there, which is really funny.
It feels very true. Probably not even a joke. Like, there's a world where I could see, sadly, someone actually delivering that eulogy.
Yeah. That might happen many, many decades from now. But yeah, very funny.
Yeah.
Tom talks to his landlord on the phone, and I think it's Mike Schur's voice. It sounds a lot like him. So I don't know if he temped it in, they just left it in, and like, yeah, whatever. Because that happens sometimes, right? It's like, you're in the edit, and you need the voice on the other end, so you just record it yourself. You just set up a mic, and then you just record it. But I think he just left it in. I think that's just him. So listen in. I mean, Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's right.
I think he just wanted his Screen Actors Guild health insurance.
I know. He had to get his dental, keep his dental insurance.
Exactly. He's no fool.
That's a big thing. It's a big thing. But yeah, the ending of this episode is pretty touching too. I thought Ron Swanson apologizing to Leslie is, we're building this relationship, which I think originally we weren't sure if this was going to kind of be the fundamental relationship in the show, but it ended up being such a spine for us. And so this is one of the seminal Leslie and Ron episodes as well. It was kind of like, oh, we get it, right? We get their relationship, and this is what we're kind of building on in the future. So,
agreed.
Doers, mowing season is here. With Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, you can get gas-like power with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower for just $329. With a runtime of nearly an hour, it's the perfect mower to tackle your half-acre lawn without a trip to the gas station. Just push and mow. Your grass won't wait, so buy it online and pick it up in-store to get out there sooner. Get gas-like power this spring with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower, just $329, during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Do we want to do a town hall? I think the answer is yes. The answer is always yes.
The answer is yes.
Are we ever going to have a show where do we want to do a town hall and you go, no?
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. Like,
you know what? I just want to get out here and put on my vest and go for a hike, Rob. So fuck the town hall.
Just the vests.
Oh, man.
We're so done. We're never going to get... People in the vest are going to spit on us.
People in the vest community, we're a protected class, and the show is oppressing us. By the way, I keep swearing in this episode. I'm like, why am I swearing so much?
It's
a weekend vibes. Oh, it's the breakfast tacos on the Saturday. Sorry. So apologies for swearing in this one. Maybe Schulte can bleep some of the swears. This is the 13 and over podcast this episode.
Yeah, because 12-year-olds never swear.
I know, right? That's like their favorite thing. Yeah. All right, let's do the town hall. I was looking over a list of locations because I was like, oh, we got to figure out where this town hall is. And I noticed a park that we would use sometimes, just a name. It was called Harvey James Park. Not, again, on the theme of using your personal experiences. We just had a friend named James Harvey, like me and Aisha, one of the writers. And so we just made it Harvey James Park, inverted the name. He was like he went to college with us, and he became a professional football player in Finland. And he was like this kind of handsome, strapping guy. And at some point, we were like, there's an episode where Rashida, Anne dates a lot of guys, and we're like, I think James Harvey should just be in the show. So we cast him in the show. This is so wild. We'll get to that episode, but I think I might have written that one. But yeah, he's just one of the guys she dates. He has like two lines. We're like, I don't know how that happened because he's not an actor. He's just a guy. Anyway, we'll do it in Harvey James Park in honor of James Harvey, a friend of mine from college. And this question comes from Sheila in New York. Did the cast ever engage in actual Parks and Rec type activities as a team building exercise? Did they prune trees or pick weeds ever? And or did the writers have any team building activities likewise?
Yeah, the only time I've done anything like that would have been community service, you know, as court mandated. That's wearing an orange jumpsuit, you know, for, you know, public intoxication with the Brat Pack. You know, I think there was a time when Judd Nelson and Andrew McCarthy and I had to dig a trench in Sylmar.
Many years ago. You put on your orange vest to do that. So
yeah, I did. I did. And listen, no one can trench like McCarthy.
Jesus.
He's a trenching fool.
Sometimes I think about the stuff you guys got away, because it's a different era. You think about, like, I feel like there was a Michael Jordan quote recently that was like, oh, I don't think I could have survived in this era of social media and stuff because of the hijinks he was getting into, or worse. I mean, the stuff that you guys were doing in the 80s, it's unfathomable. It's unfathomable.
It's literally unfathomable. And that's why you see people who are in that position today are just hidden out. It's like you don't see, like, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio partying every Friday at the Hard Rock Cafe. By the way, how funny is it that the Hard Rock Cafe was like the cat's meow? I mean,
that is so funny.
It was, though, like legit. It's like one step away from an Applebee's, it sounds like.
I mean, there was a Hard Rock Cafe at Universal City Walk that I was kind of making fun of earlier. It was like right next to the Buca di Beppo or whatever. It's like across from the movie theater. Like, that's a Hard Rock Cafe is that now. It is essentially, yeah. But that was the cool spot. That's so funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's embarrassing to say, but it really was. But yeah, no, we didn't do any team building on Parks and Rec in that way. We should have.
Yeah,
would've
that sounds fun. That sounds fun. We didn't do any like parks activities. That the writers would go on a writer's retreat before every season. So we would go stay in a hotel in Laguna Niguel by the beach, and we would be there for a few days and just try to break stories and come up with arcs for the upcoming season. So it was fun. It was a fun time. We'd do some writing. We'd have some meals together, and we'd play some like game. We'd play like Celebrity together and stuff at night. So we did a little bit of that. And then later on, you know, we took some trips, like the Parks and Rec writing staff went to Vegas together. That was fun. So it was a very tight-knit staff.
We would do, the cast would do dinners together a lot. We would do that. We would do an Indian food night, and I remember that in particular. But it was a really close cast. I mean, everybody was friends. Parks and Rec was the first show I was ever on where every single cast member organically was on a text thread. And that text thread still exists.
It survives to this day. Yes, I've heard about this group chat with the cast. That's kind of fun, you know. That's kind of a fun thing. The group chats are like the lifeblood of you know, maintaining relationships now. It's like I find, like, you know, a lot of my good friends are on different chats, and we just communicate that way, you know.
Yeah. It was good. Well, Alan, congratulations on this episode. I mean, it's got your name on it, and it's fantastique. How many did you credits do you have on the show as a writer? You know,
I think it's something like 14 or 15.
That's
some of them
amazing.
Are co-writes, but yeah, it's a lot of episodes.
Jesus, so good, Dean J. Roomba, so satisfying. I don't know what to tell you. We got vests. We got DJ Roomba. We have microfiche. Well, actually, we don't have microfiche. We wish we had microfiche.
We'll go back and shoot another Parks episode all centered around microfiche. Leslie would love it. Leslie would love microfiche. Ben Wyatt would love it.
Ben Wyatt would love it. I would and Traeger. Traeger would be down to clown
Traeger
with microfiche.
Traeger would love microfiche because he loves almost everything. He probably loves a lot. Just his body is a microchip, and his brain loves microfiche. So there you go.
Oh, there it is. That's why you got the big bucks. My body is a microchip, but my brain This is a microfiche. It works. It just kind of works. Well, there thanks for tuning in, y'all. Tuning in, that is not a good phrase. There was no tuning involved. Downloading? But that sounds so corporate. Thanks for what? What should we
thanks
say?
Thanks for listening.
Well, there you go.
Thanks for subscribing. Even better if you subscribe.
Yes.
Yes. Like and subscribe and review. 5 stars.
Which we do need you to do. Subscribe and review. 5 stars. At Apple. I guess that's the place where everybody wants to do it. Thank you. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Producer Schulte. And bye from Bunny.
Parks and Recollection is produced by Greg Levine and me, Rob Schulte. Our coordinating producer is Lisa Berm. The podcast is executive produced by Alan Yang for Alan Yang Productions, Rob Lowe for Low Profile, Jeff Ross, Adam Sachs, and Joanna Solitaroff at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson at Stitcher. Gina Batista, Paula Davis, and Britt Kahn are our talent bookers. The theme song is by Mouse Rat, a.k.a. Mark Rivers, with additional tracks composed by John Danick. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Parks and Recollection.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Stitcher.
Doers, mowing season is here. With Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, you can get gas-like power with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower for just $329. With a runtime of nearly an hour, it's the perfect mower to tackle your half-acre lawn without a trip to the gas station. Just push and mow. Your grass won't wait, so buy it online and pick it up in-store to get out there sooner. Get gas-like power this spring with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower, just $329, during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.